friends, and welcome to Conversations with Consequences, where we are changing the culture one conversation at a time. We are the radio show and podcast of the Catholic Association. We address the issues that interest you, puzzle you, and flame you in the hope that we can bring some clarity, even to the darkest corners. You can listen to Conversations with Consequences on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network, Saturday mornings at 7 a.m. Eastern Time, or you can catch the encore at 5 p.m. We are also on SiriusXM Channel 130. Of course, our radio show is always a podcast. Go to thecatholicassociation.org/podcasts or directly to wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm your hostess, Dr. Gracie Christie, alongside my co-hostess and TCA colleague, Maureen Ferguson. We're happy to welcome Dr. Brad Wilcox to the show. He is an old stalwart of our shows. He heads the National Marriage Project at the University of Virginia. But first, we are happy to have back with us an old friend of the show, Edward Penton. He's Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Register. And Edward helps us because here in the United States, we tend to be a little myopic and always staring at our belly button and thinking about what's going on in the U.S. But there's a big, wide world out there, a big, wide Catholic world. So, Edward, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Good to be with you again, Gracie.
You know, there really is so much going on. For instance, some of our listeners may not know, and I frankly have not been following it very closely, there is a synod on synodality that was launched this week at the Vatican. Tell us what a synod on synodality is and why we should be paying attention.
Well, this is something that Pope Francis is very keen to implement, and it's really to look at the first phase. So there's three phases to this, and the first phase is really to get each of the local churches to really start listening to what the faithful want to see changed in the church and how they feel the church can be better. And so the first phase is called a diocesan phase. So there's going to be from Sunday, from the 17th, there's going to be basically, it begins with liturgies in each diocese, and then it'll become a very wide sort of consultation with faithful from across the world in the local churches. And then that will be brought together, all of the results will be brought together next year, and this time next year it'll begin a national phase, so that each national church will have do the same sort of thing, but in a more universal sense. And then there'll be a culminating synod in 2023, in October 2023, in the Vatican, where all these issues will be brought together and sort of hammered out. And I think the hope is that it'll get a better picture of what's needed in the church and regarding what the needs are of the local faithful and the church as an institution in general. So that's basically what the Pope has planned.
So this, Edward, this reminds me of the Synod on the Family. That's the way the Family Synod was organized. There was a listening time with all the different parts of the world church paying attention and giving their feedback, and then a collection of all the bishops got together, and then we found the results. But
yes.
But that was a very, the Synod on the Family was on the family, something that we all understand and we all have ideas about, and we feel that we understand the needs of the family. We all live in families. But what about synodality? What is synodality exactly? And what does the church want to hear from us as far as synodality?
Well, I think the synodality, as I say, it's about creating what Pope Francis says is a more listening church. But there are still sort of question marks about what exactly that means. And you get sort of conflicting arguments, whether it's the sort of difference between synodality and collegiality. Collegiality was, of course, very much a concept that was emphasized at the Second Vatican Council, which was to make the hierarchy more collegial, but also to help bring a sort of to give people more say within the church who perhaps hadn't been heard before. And this is really what's being held down with synodality too. It's really to try to, I think, make the church in a sense a little more like a democracy, and to try to make the structure of the church less sort of top down. But as Pope Francis once said at a very important speech on synods back in 2015, I believe, which was, I think, the, or 2016, which was the the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Synod of Bishops by Paul VI. He said he really wanted to what he called an inverted pyramid, which is very much the church guided by the grassroots from the ground up rather than from the top down. And so I think that's the sort of direction he wants the church to head. And I think he's wanting this synod, this particular synod, to do that and to be a way to move that forward. But, it is controversial. There are many questions about it, many of which I asked Cardinal Grech in an interview I did with him last week about this, and, questions about whether it's sort of Protestantizing the church, as some believe, or it's basically a Vatican III, a third Vatican Council, but without naming it as such, and then whether, it's sort of trying to implement sort of revolutionary element into the church, which hasn't been asked for by many laity, and wonders whether there's a sort of hidden agenda behind it. Now, of course, he denied all of that and said basically what I've said just now about what synodality is. But a big question about this synod is, they're going to be talking to a lot of uncatechized faithful, and the question is, is the census fidei, as Cardinal Grech says, does it include such people and such faithful, or does it include those who are catechized? Because it's a very different view you're going to get from the faithful who are uncatechized than those who are. And of course, if for those who aren't sort of well versed in church teaching, it's going to be quite a different sort of outcome if you're going to listen more to them than those who are catechized, who tend to be the minority now, because, as people often say, the catechesis in the church for the past 50 years has not been optimal by any means. So there are lots of uncatechized, perhaps the majority, well, clearly the majority of the Catholics in the world are not properly catechized. So this is a real question mark about the whole process and just how it's going to be fulfilled because of that.
It does seem to have an air of putting the cart before the horse and having the cart decide where the horses ought to go. But there is a lack of catechesis everywhere. And I think more than that, a lack of confidence on the part of church, of the clergy, a lack of confidence in their ability to transmit the eternal truths of our faith. And also a lack of confidence that people will receive them as what they are, which is life-saving and joyful news from God as to our condition and our purpose in life. So I do think it does sound a little scary, especially when I hear the word synod, I often think of the German synod, which is a troubling, it's very troubling to think of a whole group of German bishops sort of taking their own way, going off in a different direction or trying to pull the church in a direction which the church has never walked. What do you think about that kind of synodality?
Well, it's interesting because I was in touch with Cardinal Walter Kasper about this. Now, Cardinal Kasper is interesting because he's very much on the sort of liberal wing of the church, who's very favorable to this sort of process because he believes it's a way to introduce these more liberal elements into the church, which wouldn't have been accepted otherwise. And so he's a very much a proponent of this, but he is a leading opponent, or at least has great concerns about the German synodal path, which he says is a different process. I mean, he says, and I quote, he says, it's an attempt to realize a certain more or less controversial agenda of church reform. And the synodal assembly has a vote, but it's very much, run by votes. But he says, votes with a universal impact must be sent to the Holy See. But the Pope's synodal process, he says, doesn't have such a pre-given agenda of reform, which the German synodal path does.
So when the Germans sit down in synod, they have an agenda before them that's preset, and then they vote on certain things. Is that how that works?
Exactly. Well, exactly. This is the leading criticism of the German synodal path, is that it's basically got a preset agenda, which is using the sexual abuse crisis as a means to push through this agenda. And it's a sort of political, ecclesiastical agenda, very much sort of secular. And this is the sort of reform that they're wanting. Now, Cardinal Kasper says that the Pope's synodal process is not primarily reform-oriented, but it's a spiritual process. And he invites the local churches within the Universal Church to pray and listen to the gospel, listen in a brotherly way, as he says, to each other and find out what the Spirit is telling the church. Now, of course, it could be just playing with words in a sense, because you could argue that, you know, the Holy Spirit could be saying, well, you know, we need the same sort of reforms that they're doing in the German church, and who's to know whether that's correct or not? I mean, that's when you get the majority of people voting in that, that's what they might say.
But, and terrifyingly, in the German synod, they voted on same-sex blessings being allowed in church or being done at church, and they got enough votes to pass that.
Right. You see, so, and this is the sort of agenda that they're trying to push through anyway. That's not going to happen. I'm pretty sure that won't happen in this process. But at the same time, much like the previous synods, there'll be, I think, certain reforms placed, put through, but in a more sort of oblique way. And
you mean sort of in a subtle, hard to parse out kind of way that we saw in the results of other synods?
Yes, well, like very much like Amoris Laetitia, which was the document that came out of the Family Synod. You had, of course, the famous footnote, which basically allowed, certain people who were divorced and remarried who could receive Holy Communion, and it kind of gave that a sort of green light depending on the circumstances. And so you got the same sort of possible. Same sort of possible danger accruing in this synod that's to come. So we'll have to see. But I think there are certainly dangers with this whole process. But the Pope, you know, he says, well, you know, we've got to trust the Holy Spirit, and the Holy Spirit will guide the church. And so there's nothing really to fear.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Conversations with Consequences. I'm your hostess, Dr. Gracie Christie, and we're talking to Edward Penton. He's the Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Register and an expert on all things Vatican. We're talking about the Synod on Synodality. You know, you mentioned, you said the word earlier, the Protestantization, if I'm saying that properly.
Yes.
And there is this, you know, you speak to me about the synod and synodality and people listening and taking their own paths. And, you know, it does sound Protestant to me, the idea that the church could become this democratic grassroots organization, in which case it's dangerous to me to think in that way, because we could break down into 1,000 different denominations. I mean, how has the church stayed a single church, you know, for 2,000 years?
Right. I mean, it's interesting if you talk to, and I am a former Anglican, but if you talk to former Anglicans, particularly in the church, they will say, we had this sort of process in the Anglican church, and it was an absolute disaster. I mean, you had all sorts of ideas put across that actually became sort of mainstream, and then you had women priests, you had same-sex blessings and all kinds of things. And I think there's a fear that that's sort of being replicated in the Catholic Church, but of course the Catholic Church is different in that it is a divine and human institution, and the argument is that, you know, that the gates of hell will not prevail against it, and it will not be led into error, and so there is nothing really to fear. And I think this is perhaps the Pope's view, that you have to be, as he says, with Peter and under Peter, you have to trust that what he is doing is in conformity with the gospel and with the Holy Spirit, and that everything is going to be okay. And so I think there is that difference, but at the same time, you know, the critics will say, and you know, they have a point, that it does bring certain confusion, and all this sort of threshing out of ideas can be very confusing to people, and especially the media will grab on to any sort of the mainstream media will grab on to any kind of indication that the church is perhaps succumbing to more secular values, and that can always be, these sort of issues can always be raised during a synod, and so that sort of gives fodder to the mainstream media that the church is sort of changing in that way.
And it's very sad, Edward, because here on the ground of the church, as what I'm experiencing out in the world, is the church is becoming more and more of it's being seen as a refuge from, the dangerous ideologies that are part of the secular culture. And people, you know, are wishing that they could afford to send their kids to parochial school or you know, doing everything they can to send their kids to Catholic school and protect them from these ideologies, which are being, they're just being diffused like poison into every part of our wider culture. And so it is somewhat scary then to think that the church wants to sort of open itself to this kind of thing and see what we pick and choose from it. It seems to me a terrible plan.
Well, I think one also has to distinguish between the church, of course, which is incorruptible and cannot be led into error, and the leaders within it who unfortunately can. And I think there's a difference there, and one has to, I think, cling to the fact that the sacrament's always the same and they're incorruptible, and that the church never really changes in that respect.
Well, and that's how we know it's divine, right? Because we haven't humans have not been able to destroy it.
Exactly.
And no matter how hard they've tried.
Right. Yes. Especially the leaders. Yeah. Yes.
How do you see, Edward, how do you see the terrible and sad, I don't even want to talk about it, frankly, but the terrible, the clerical abuse sex scandals that have rocked our world for so long, and they keep rocking our world. How do you see all of that affecting the church and this this idea of synodality and grassroots Catholicism?
Well, I think it does play a role in this, and of course it's caused a lot of the impetus behind these kind of issues. We've had, of course, the Vatican Summit on Sexual Abuse. I think it was 2019, and you know this. This is all sort of pushing towards a greater listening of those who are victims, and that's all well and good. But I think there's a danger, or at least there's talk of dangers of this, that it can lead to, you know, listening perhaps to those who do feel sort of they have gripes against the church, and they have, you know, grievances rather, and those get listened to perhaps rather too much, and then you've got decisions taken which aren't really in the best interest of the church as a whole, and the, you know, sort of hard cases make bad law, and I think you can get that in this sort of situation. So I think there's a danger there, and you know, people will say, well, the whole sexual abuse crisis is really Satan's work, and he's certainly the crimes are, but it's being used by him to really try to destroy the church, and that is something I think you know, one has to be wary of.
And now, of course, the church is coming, where all of us are coming at all of this at the end of this long COVID nightmare we've all been living through, and all the different ways it has affected us. It's separated us. It's caused a lot of conflict. Even at the Vatican, we're seeing conflict over things like vaccine mandates. Are you in Italy right now?
Yes, I am. I'm in Rome, yes.
And how are things? How are things there? And I know that maybe some of our listeners have heard that some of the Swiss Guard have walked away due to vaccine mandates. Is that something that's talked about around the Vatican?
Well, it is, but it's interesting to see how little that story, which is a pretty big story, really, has been ignored, whether by the mainstream press or even Catholic media. I mean, we put it in the Register, but there are very few that really saw this as a major story. But it's really quite interesting how, you know, you have, contrary to the note that was put out by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith last December, which said that vaccines should always be voluntary, they shouldn't be mandatory. And yet you had the Swiss Guard being forced to take the vaccine. They couldn't just have the green pass, which is this, you know, you can have tests instead of taking the vaccine. They had to have the vaccine. And so you had these three Swiss Guard who were fired because of that, and three others were suspended, because they wouldn't take it, and despite, you know, all the ethical problems behind it, the fact that they've all been either tested or produced using aborted fetal stem cells, and then other issues, of course, other concerns about their effectiveness and their safety, and serious concerns, and I think that's, those issues are kind of cast aside, and really it's led by the Pope. The fact that the Pope has been very strong on this and has said it's a moral duty to take the vaccine, and he's really been very, very strong on this and very adamant that the vaccine be taken. And so it's really interesting that this has happened in the Vatican, and I think also wider afield in Italy as a whole. It's, I think Italy is one of the most restrictive when it comes to the vaccine, and one of the most they really want the vaccine to be taken, and they're trying to get the numbers up as much as they can.
And are people in Italy fighting back, as we have seen in other countries?
Yes, we had quite serious riots here on Saturday evening, where you had lots of quite a large number of protesters in the center of Rome, and they had to use water cannon and tear gas to try to calm them down. But it was I think when you look at the videos, it was kind of the aggression seemed to be caused mostly by the authorities, not by those who are protesting. So it's people are very concerned. Of course, on the 15th of October, a new restriction comes in Italy, where every employer has to have a green pass. That doesn't mean they have to be vaccinated, but they have to either get the vaccine or have a test every 72 hours. So the restrictions are really quite heavy. And I think a lot of people are starting to wonder, why is it these restrictions are so heavy? If the vaccine is so effective and if there is the pandemic really is so serious, why is there this pressure to get the vaccine? And I think that the answer to that question, I don't think many people has been answered.
Well, I think it's to some extent in every country, everyone's feeling very insecure about what the people in charge know and how are they using their knowledge. Even from a scientific perspective, it's very hard to know what to believe and how to move forward. And, you know, also very interesting also at the Vatican, and I wanted to ask you about this. The Pontifical Academy of Social Sciences had an event recently, and they had some pro-abortion politicians there. They had socialist economists. Mm. Some of the topics that they discussed were universal basic income, green politics, zero COVID. Why was this going on at the Vatican? What was the Vatican trying to do here?
Well, this is a bit of a pattern of ongoing events that have been held, particularly at the Pontifical Academy for Social Sciences, where they've tend to have had speakers who are of this background. They're not necessarily Catholic. They certainly have un-Catholic views, particularly on key issues, key moral issues like abortion. And they're brought in really just to discuss very much a sort of leftist political sort of approach to world issues, and some would say a sort of globalist approach. And this is very much in play at this conference last week, which brought together, as you said, these very much socialist economists and pro-abortion politicians. And one of the key issues they were proposing was universal basic income, which is essentially just free money to give to people, and it's something that Pope Francis is sympathetic to. He called it an unconditional lump sum payment to all citizens, which could be paid through the tax system. So it's a sort of free welfare, if you like, for everybody.
And it sounds like a disincentive to work to me.
Well, exactly. This is the criticism of it. But it's being pushed by, among others, the World Economic Forum, who are very much pushing this Great Reset project that many listeners will probably know about, and also being pushed by the UN. And so it's very much the Vatican coming in to sync with these sort of global intergovernmental initiatives, which seem to be run by an elite, by a sort of globalist elite, who want sort of big government and a sort of one world government, some would say. And that the Vatican is sort of going full square along with it.
Wow, that's a little that's a little scary. And it's interesting, and it always is the elite, right? Because it seems to me very very obvious that kind of thing would tend to limit human flourishing and limit mostly the lives of the people who, you know, at the bottom scale, not at the top of the economic scale.
Yes, and this is what's the mystery, because, you know, the free market does tend to help the poor. It brings everybody up rather than leveling down. Whereas this sort of vision, I think critics will say, well, it really levels down, like much like socialism. Mm-hmm. It's just a sort of another form of socialism. So how is that going to help the poor? And so it's a mystery why, when the Pope is so keen on helping the poor, that he'll favour these kinds of approaches. And this whole idea of wealth creation and that people need to be free to create wealth and entrepreneurship and so forth is not really considered, and it's not given any kind of emphasis at all. So it's a mystery. I mean, some people have theories, of course, why this is so, but
I was hoping when Pope Francis came to the United States, he would get a better feel for capitalism than what he might have seen in Argentina, where corruption is so intense.
Yes, I know. It's a strange thing that he didn't. But I mean, obviously, there are problems with capitalism as well. But it seems like that's sort of thrown out the window in favor of this more sort of big government sort of statist approach, which still favors the free market in a sense, but it's a sort of Chinese model, which I think is more the sort of model that they're favoring more, which is another concern given the problems with China.
Now we've talked, Edward, we're almost out of time, and we've talked about sort of sad and worrisome things, but I want to ask you about something happy. Cardinal Burke getting better from COVID.
Yes. Well, I haven't heard much lately, but I understand that he's up and about, and he's celebrating Mass. So I think he's well on the road to recovery, which is great for those who are interested in this and following his health at the moment. So yes, he's doing well, I think.
Well, that's fabulous. Lots of us were praying for him. That's really good news that he's better.
Yes. And he hopes, I think, to come back to Rome in the next month or so. It's a long sort of convalescence he has.
Oh, I'm sure.
You know, of course, as a doctor, so it's a long...
Yeah, those lungs have to get back to their normal state. It takes a little time.
Exactly.
Well, yes. Edward, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations with Consequence. It's always a blessing to have you, and we can't thank you enough for sharing your time with us and your perspective.
Sure.
To our listeners, if you'd like to follow Edward's work and writing, you can visit ncregister.com. Thank you so much, Edward.
Thanks, Gracie. My pleasure.
Every morning, the Catholic Association reviews all the latest news and sends our subscribers a carefully curated collection of the most important news of the day. Items are specifically selected for a smart Catholic audience like you. Don't let the world take you by surprise. Subscribe to our daily media roundup at thecatholicassociation.org. Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences. I'm your hostess, Dr. Gracie Christie, alongside my co-hostess and TCA colleague, Maureen Ferguson. We're happy to welcome Dr. Brad Wilcox to the show. He is an old stalwart of our shows. He heads the National Marriage Project at the University of Virginia. You can catch some of his research and writing at the Institute for Family Studies. That's familystudies.org. Welcome to the show, Brad.
It's great to be here today.
Well, Brad, we wanted to have you on because you did and released a survey, which we thought was extremely interesting. It's called the American Family Survey. Could you tell our listeners about the survey?
So this is a new survey from the Deseret News and BYU, and it's run by YouGov, and it's an annual survey that's designed to kind of give us a sense of the family pulse in America. And so a lot of questions on topics related to family and parenting and, you know, the challenges that people face today when it comes to, you know, both getting married, staying married, and raising kids.
As you've mentioned, the world's been turned upside down in the last year and a half. So, and we've seen, of course, a lot of suffering within families, but we've also seen a lot of resilience. So can you tell us a little bit about how this survey captured that amidst the disruptions of the pandemic?
Yeah, you know, when COVID first hit and the lockdown started to begin, people thought that divorce would spike and that, you know, couples would be in, you know, just a terrible spot. But this survey, both in 2021 and 2020, has found that people are much more likely to report that their sense of commitment and appreciation for their spouse has risen since COVID hit, and that, you know, conflicts, although certainly there's a minority of couples reporting, you know, more conflict because of COVID, but, you know, the more common response is, you know, more commitment, more appreciation for your spouse, not some kind of devastating effect. And in fact, we kind of or look beyond just sort of the couple relationship quality issues to sort of people's more general reports of sadness, loneliness, and satisfaction with their lives. We're just seeing that married people are doing a lot better, right now than single Americans. It gives us some sense that, like, yeah, I mean, and we all know that marriage can be tough and difficult at times. But what we're seeing right now is that on average, Americans who are married are doing better than their unmarried counterparts. And in fact, the gap in satisfaction in this survey has been growing from 2015 to the present. That is, there's a kind of premium when it comes to happiness that married people enjoy today that seems to be getting a little bit bigger from year to year.
And what do you attribute that to? That people are appreciating the joys of marriage more, or that marriage itself is delivering more, quantitatively positive things?
Well, you know, the funny thing, or maybe the tragic thing to say right now, to be frank, is that married people's happiness is not increasing. What is decreasing is unmarried people's happiness, right? And so it looks to me like, I think about this sort of, I don't think that my wife and I were kind of happier in 2020 amidst, COVID. But we had a lot of kids. We were pretty busy. We weren't sort of cooped up on Zoom, 24/7. And so I think what sort of might be happening, in fact, is that people who are not married, people who are single, are more likely to be struggling these days, and that the pandemic only kind of made that the challenge of being single that much greater. So in a world where we're seeing more economic stability, where we're seeing political polarization, where we're seeing a social distrust rising, I think people who are in families are more protected, more buffered against a lot of the stuff that's happening in the broader culture.
Yeah, it's interesting when you look through the survey, and it can be found at aei.org for our listeners. When you look through the survey, there are some interesting things. For instance, 57% of people surveyed said that children are better off if they have two married parents, but also only 28% of people thought it was morally wrong to have a child outside of marriage. So it's interesting, I think, that people are seeing the benefits of married parenting, of stable families and families built, to last. And at the same time, they don't want to pass judgment on people who go ahead and have children outside of marriage.
Yeah, I think there's a recognition on the part of plenty of folks that other things being equal, it's great to be raised by two married parents. But at the same time, in a world where where kind of a certain regard for kind of being tolerant or accepting has, become very important, people are reluctant to kind of cast any kind of judgment. For instance, having a child out of wedlock.
Is this what you refer to as the marriage paradox, Brad, when you talk about how upper middle class Americans sort of profess to have no problem with non-marital childbearing, for example, profess that all kinds of family structure is equal, but yet in their own private lives embrace that marriage mindset for themselves, for their children, sort of recognizing that there's a formula for success there?
Exactly. Yeah, no, you put it perfectly. I mean, I think what's striking is we did a different survey in California about a year and a half ago, and what we found, the Californians who are college educated were more likely to profess their support for family diversity than their less educated fellow citizens in California. So that was sort of their public ethic. We're a four-family university. But then we asked them, is your kind of your plan to have kids in marriage, and then are you stably married? And of course, the college-educated Californians were, the most likely to plan on having kids in marriage and to be stably married with their kids. So there's a kind of what I call kind of amoral familism operating here, where people have like a public position that's sort of amoral around their kind of family issues, but their own lives are often very family-centered.
Well, I think they're being very practical, right? I mean, you see the practical results of doing things in a certain, what you call the success pattern, and you see that all around you.
Right, there's a pragmatism. So these are the people, who are in the health club regularly, who eat well, who watch their weight, who are on their kids, get the homework done, who are very aware that all these things kind of have a long-term impact on their health, their financial well-being, their longevity, their kids' success, and marriage is just part of that puzzle, and so practically they're very pro-marriage, but kind of politically and publicly, and when it comes to kind of making any noise about like what's happening in the public school, for instance, there's just an unwillingness to, support marriage as a public institution, and that's tragic.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Conversations with Consequences. I'm your hostess, Dr. Gracie Christie, along with my co-hostess, Maureen Ferguson from the Catholic Association. And we're talking to Brad Wilcox. He heads the National Marriage Project at the University of Virginia. Something else that popped out at me on the survey is that 85% of respondents said that parents should set boundaries on media consumption for their children. I've been thinking a lot about media consumption. I've been reading the Facebook files from the Wall Street Journal, reading those horrible things about TikTok that have been exposed, the congressional hearings on the same topic. People seem to be waking up to the dangers of constant internet consumption for their kids. Do you think that this will translate into some kind of action down the road on the parental side?
So I would say two things. One is that, you know, I think more parents are trying to figure out how they can corral their kids' time on the internet and the content of the materials their kids are engaging with on the internet. I mean, that's all to the good. But I think secondly, we have to realize there's kind of a collective action problem here where it'd be helpful to have some support from Washington on these issues. So, you know, we're not going to censor the internet, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I think we could give parents more power to control things like, you know, their router, you know, and things like their family cell phone plans. So it should be, you know, I think it should be the case, for instance, that, you know, these big tech can't do ads on social media for kids, and that would have a big impact on, you know, on their whole business model. I think that parents should have the ability to just press a button and, you know, kind of eliminate porn from their family cell phone network and from their modems, like their DSL service. And I think that, you know, the same thing, especially with the universal, you know, kill switch, you can just hit a button on your cell phone that turns off all the phones in the family network and, you know, turns off the DSL. So I was just kind of just giving parents, you know, easier ways to kind of control the technology.
Really, because what parents have the time or are tech savvy enough to figure out these parental controls? Because our tech savvy kids can quickly find workarounds, of course.
I have to keep relearning it. Periodically, I have to go back into my phone and re-understand how to control the amount of time and the content. It's very complicated.
Right. No, that's true. I'm just saying, I think that there could be easier ways to give some parents some very simple mechanisms that would allow them to do that kind of, I mean, you know, just like you press a button and the whole network goes down from, you know, whatever, it's 10 o'clock at night until 7 in the morning. But right now you have to buy, you know, an additional software platform or you have to, an app, or you have to, you know, as you say, kind of go through your iPhone and figure out all these different things. It's just not very straightforward. And I think this is where I would say the government actually could make our jobs easier as parents in terms of controlling this stuff. These are the kinds of things, and you disagree with one particular thing that I've said, but I think what we should be exploring are both ways to encourage parents, but also to encourage policymakers, you know, to, you know, give us more tools in the sort of fight against big tech.
What about gaming and boys, Brad? How do you see that affecting young men?
I think gaming is, I think for girls it's social media, for boys it's gaming. And, you know, I think, again, the challenge is to kind of, you know, give your boys, you know, say 1 hour on an evening and 2 hours on a weekend or some kind of norm where you're limiting time. And the challenge, too, is to find other teenage boys and their families that would, like, be interested in kind of doing things besides gaming, is too, because that's a challenge that parents face, is that their son's friends are online all the time. And so, you know, if you can kind of even get together with, you know, your son's friends' families and try to figure out, you know, what things can we do to encourage our boys to, you know, play basketball outside, to, you know, do some kind of, you know, other set of activities, you know, outside would be definitely viable. And then I think encouraging sons too to be involved in organized sports as well as just one way to kind of get outside and get that exercise. It's so good for us, you know, in terms of our emotional well-being, but also in terms of kind of, like, I think, you know, there's a way in which the more that our sons exercise, the more prepared they are to actually get homework done as well.
I do think that parental collusion is so important and key by, you know, finding your kids' friends, parents, and getting together to say, okay, we're going to keep the genie in the bottle on social media or gaming or whatever. There's a website called Wait Until 8th, which is excellent in terms of giving ideas for how parents can get together and decide side together so that your kid is not the only one who's left out.
Well, Brad, thank you so much for joining us today. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Thank you for going through interesting information from the survey, and thank you for your good ideas. I especially like your thoughts on the internet, because I agree that it's true that we have to find new ways to get a hold of that problem, all of us as Americans.
Yeah, well, thanks, Gracie and Maureen, for having me on today. I appreciate the chance to speak with you guys.
For more information on Dr. Brad Wilcox's work, please go to familystudies.org. Super interesting stuff, right, Maureen? Because it does sort of give you a snapshot of where people's heads are now after a couple years of COVID. Definitely, we've all been shook up.
It does. The disruption has been incredible on so many different levels. So it was interesting to see kind of some things held steady through the pandemic, other things not. But it's always interesting to hear from him. He's such a great sociologist and has so many insights on the family.
You know, there was some news. This week we have a new Vatican ambassador. I thought we could talk about that for a moment, because it's rather a big deal.
Well, it is, and this is always a rather sticky situation diplomatically when you have a democratic administration that is pro-abortion, and particularly sticky if you have a Democrat who also professes to be a devout Catholic, because there are not too many people left in the Democratic Party who are pro-life, but the Vatican will not receive an ambassador from the United States who is not pro-life. So it's...
Maureen, explain that to me. How do they not receive him? They say this ambassador is not pro-life, we won't take him?
I think they back channel ahead of time that they will only accept and receive an ambassador.
But it's a firm. It's a firm no. We won't do it.
I believe so.
Wow.
I believe that's...
That's nice.
That's how the story is told anyway, that it's a firm no, that the Vatican will only accept an ambassador who is pro-life, which is wonderful.
That's wonderful.
So it's just always an interesting search within the Democratic Party to find a person of stature who is pro-life. And just this past week, it was announced that former Senator Joe Donnelly of Indiana has received the appointment. He'll have to be confirmed. But I think it was a good pick. I really do. Senator Donnelly was a congressman for maybe perhaps just one term. He represented the congressional district that includes the University of Notre Dame. His wife, Jill, is somebody I know. She works at the University of Notre Dame. She's actually retired now, I think, but was a longtime employee at the University of Notre Dame. So Joe and Jill Donnelly are sort of well-known in Catholic circles. Senator Donnelly did maintain a largely pro-life voting record in the Senate. Perhaps it was not perfect, but it was pretty darn good. So I have to say, I think it's a great pick, and I think he will do an excellent job as ambassador to the Vatican.
That's good to know, because we haven't had a lot of positives out of this administration on the Catholic side, have we?
Well, he's got a very tough job because of the many policy contradictions that he's going to have to deal with. So he's got a lot to navigate. It's a terrible look on such a fundamental issue to our faith and such a fundamental human rights issue to have an administration that is so actively promoting and abortion, but not just in the United States, but around the world. There is serious cultural imperialism going on around the world through our foreign aid, pressuring foreign governments to liberalize their abortion policies. So it's not just a domestic problem, it is an international problem. And it's a very interesting diplomatic situation. And I'm sure Senator Donnelly, who will soon likely be confirmed as Ambassador Donnelly, I'm sure he'll find many areas to... you know, areas of common ground to work on, things like human trafficking and such. But it will be a sticky walk for him. There will be landmines all over the place, I think, for him. But I just think personally, he's a good guy and he'll do his best to navigate those landmines.
Well, we should pray for him, and we should pray that that the United States, under its current iteration, its current administration, and the Vatican can find lots of good things to work on together to promote Catholic social teaching, at least in the ways that they can agree, which is not the life issue.
And hopefully Senator Donnelly will be able to have some frank conversations with the president. The Holy Father, of course, has been very clear on the abortion issue and the tragedy of abortion and what a violation it is of human rights. So hopefully Senator Donnelly and President Biden, who have a lot in common, two Irish Catholics of similar background, I think we can hope that Senator Donnelly will have some frank conversations with President Biden. I don't know if I'm terribly hopeful it would lead to a change of heart, but we can always pray, as you said.
Well, miracles happen, so we keep praying for them. And thank you, Maureen, for joining me this week on Conversations with Consequences. I love my co-hostess, Maureen Ferguson.
Good to talk with you today, Gracie.
And now Father Roger Landry offers us, as is customary, a short and inspiring homily to prepare us for this Sunday's gospel.
This is Father Roger Landry, and it's a privilege for me to be with you as we enter into the consequential conversation the risen Lord Jesus wants to have with each of us this Sunday. When we will eavesdrop on the dialogue Jesus has with the apostles James and John, and then with all of the other apostles on the subject of ambition. The brothers James and John, with great chutzpah, ask Jesus for a blank check. Teacher, they say, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you. Jesus indulges them, asking, what do you wish for me to do for you? And they reply, grant that in your glory we may sit one at your right and the other at your left. The two fishermen wanted to be the Messiah's right and left-hand men, his two viceroys or executive vice presidents, what they anticipated would be Jesus' glorious messianic reign. But Jesus responded, you do not know what you're asking, and then gave them yet another indication of the expectation-shattering type of kingdom he was establishing. Can you drink the cup that I drink, or be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized? He asked, alluding to the cup of suffering prophesied by Isaiah and the cleansing ablution of blood that would take place on Good Friday. To his question, the brothers impetuously respond, we can. Jesus foretold that they ultimately would, but reminded them that God the Father had already prepared those who would sit on his right and his left, which would be the good and bad thief on Calvary, the sheep and the goats at the general judgment, and likely, dynamically, Mary and Joseph in heaven. Hearing this conversation, however, the other 10 apostles objected and became angry at James and John, not because of the brothers' impudence, but out of their own jealousy. They themselves wanted the positions that the brothers had the guts to ask for. Their anger gave Jesus the opportunity to give one of the most important instructions to the apostle and to the whole church about the path to greatness, about the means to become like him, about the way to reign with him and advance his kingdom. We need to focus carefully and persistently on what Jesus says, because it goes so much against our worldly ways. 4 weeks ago, you may recall, we had an opportunity to focus on ambition and the path to greatness in God's kingdom, because the theme was so common in St. Mark's gospel, because the apostles were so obsessed about which one of them would be the greatest, and their voracious, egocentric hunger came to the surface at least 4 times, all disgustingly when Jesus spoke about how he would suffer, be betrayed, and crucified to establish his kingdom. We spoke then about how Jesus didn't seek to suppress their ambition, but to reorient it, pushing them to become great in faith, great in humility, great in holiness, great in knowing and transmitting the faith by word and example, and great in sacrificial love. This Sunday, we focus with Jesus on that last Christian ambition. Jesus tells the apostles, you know that those who are recognized as rulers over the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones make their authority over them felt. It's still the same way today. Greatness is determined by how much power one wields in politics, how much money or influence one has in business, how many magazine covers and Twitter followers one has in entertainment. Greatness is determined by the capacity to command or lead others from above. Jesus says that in his kingdom, it can't be that way. Whoever wishes to be great among you, he states emphatically, will be your servant. Whoever wishes to be first among you will be the slave of all. In his kingdom, those who are great would lead in love from below, from serving, sacrificing, even dying for others. Then he gives the reason. For the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus was calling them not to lord it over others, but under others. To be great, in other words, would come not principally through sharing Christ's power, but by sharing his love. Jesus would put these words about serving others rather than being served into action during the celebration of the Last Supper on the night he was betrayed, when he stood up, took off his outer garment, tied a towel around his waist, began to wash the filth off his disciples' feet, a menial task normally done by servants and slaves. The apostles naturally resisted Jesus debasing himself in this way. After he was finished, Jesus said, do you know what I have done for you? You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for indeed I am. So if I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I've set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. Real greatness in Christ's kingdom would not be determined by fighting for seats at table, but by fighting for the towel. The highest would not be the one to whom others would lift glasses and toasts, but the one who would be able to drink the cup of Christ's blood and in turn say to others with Christ, "This is my blood shed for you." Christ's cabinet would be filled not by those who would kiss his butt, but those who would put their own butts on the line for him and others, by being baptized into his death through their own suffering and death. The greatness to which Jesus wants us to aspire, therefore, has nothing to do with any type of terrestrial pecking order. Real greatness, he described, is to become most like him, to share his greatness, his holiness, his total self-giving love. 20 times in the gospel, Jesus told his disciples, "Follow me." And in this Sunday's gospel, Jesus was telling us that the path to greatness is to do what he himself was doing. "For the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for the many." St. Paul would later to describe to the Philippians that Christ's example was the stairway to heaven when he called on us to imitate it. "Do nothing," he wrote, "from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility regard others as better than yourselves. Let each of you look not to your own interests, but to the interests of others. Let the same mind be in you that was in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not regard equality with God something to be exploited, but emptied himself, taking the form of a slave, being born in human likeness. Being found in human form, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, death on a cross." This self-abasing, loving service is the root of Christ's greatness. John and James and the other apostles were chosen by Jesus because, even though at first they had very human and selfish desires and motivations, they were capable of conversion so that Jesus' categories would eventually become their own. Once they saw the fullness of Jesus' teaching in his suffering, death, and resurrection on Good Friday, they experienced a real metamorphosis, a total transformation of their worldly ambition into Christ-like ambition. They saw that the path to prominence was not lined with glitter, but thorns. This is obviously not an easy conversion, but 11 of the 12 of them eventually made it. They drank Christ's cup, they were baptized into his death, and now they are seated at his side in heaven. The Lord Jesus wants all of us to undergo the same transformation. He wants all of us to desire true greatness, to trade in our false notions that real greatness means we have butlers and valets, chauffeurs and private pilots, and a whole staff of people at our beck and call, to a notion that the greater we are, the more we will in fact be serving others. But having the intellectual notion isn't enough. Jesus wants to give us the help he knows we need to make the choice to follow him on this path to greatness. This is the way that after the resurrection the apostles chose. This is the way that the saints choose. When St. Gregory the Great, for example, Pope from 590 to 604, signed his letters, unlike previous popes who used the expressions Vicar of Christ or Bishop of Rome or Pontifex Maximus, literally the greatest bridge builder between heaven and earth, or the successor of St. Peter, Gregory signed his letters Gregorius Servus Servorum Dei, Gregory, the servant to the servants of God. And he earned that title, giving all he had in service to Christ's flock, each of whom is called to be God's servant. For Gregory, the church hierarchy was founded by the Lord to be a lowerarchy, to be a ladder of service. The same goes for every hierarchy. Those who have been invested by the Lord with greater responsibilities, whether in the domestic church of the home, the parish, the diocese, the workplace, the school, are called by the Lord to serve the rest and help them learn to serve others. They're never called to lord it over others, but to love others as Christ loved them, serving them in the same self-giving way with which the Lord has served us all. For Christ, to reign is not to be served, but to serve, to give one's life in exchange for others. Anyone who wishes to reign with Christ must do likewise. All of us, as did Gregory, are called to become servants of all the servants of God. And this will be the means by which others after us, and most importantly the Lord, will call us great, just like we call Gregory. The greatest means Jesus gives us to become great occurs at Mass. When he humbly bent down at the beginning of the Last Supper to wash his followers' feet, he was just getting started. Later he would abase himself further, changing bread and wine into his body and blood, so that we as servants could consume him and live off him. This is the chalice he places before us to drink, to which he hopes we will respond with as much trust and zeal as John and James did. Jesus, in giving himself in ransom for us in the Eucharist, wants us to make that type of love the path of our life. He simplifies everything he's taught us about the path to true greatness in the words he will say to us again on Sunday. "Do this in memory of me."
Thank you, Father Landry. To hear more from Father Landry, check out his website at catholicpreaching.com, and you can also catch his writings at EWTN's own National Catholic Register. A big thank you to all our listeners for joining us. I hope that this show was helpful. I hope that it gave you more peace and more hope and more joy, and you go with our prayers.